Hey, thank you, everybody. We are on page 239 in volume 4. Okay, so when it comes to the din of insects, there's a bit of an irony here, because for most of us, the majority of the time we spend and the energies we extend in order to keep kosher is mostly connected to the separation of milk and meat. Especially in our time now in New York, certainly getting the right kosher product is phenomenally easy. Even Trader Joe's alone puts out a list of over 100 different hashgacha organizations. Forget about how many products they have that are kosher. You has thousands upon thousands of kosher products that are manufactured around the world, never mind around America. You can go to an out-of-the-way chain someplace out in Arizona, and you'll find it's just amazing. I was recently upstate, and just so many products. Not a Jew for miles and miles around, but there's so many products there that are covered by Hashgacha. So the proper kosher product, very easy to get. Kosher meat, kosher poultry, kosher fish, all available all around. Frozen and fresh. And the milchiks and fleishiks is pretty much, the separate dishes. You mixed up a spoon in the fleishik dishwasher. You use the milchik plate in the fleishik microwave. You put in a fleishik spoon in the cheese omelet that you're making on the, in the pan. So these are the questions most of the time that I get when it comes to any kosher issue from your kitchen. So the irony is in a few manners. One is that insects are should be far more a far greater concern for us for a few reasons. One, most of the cases that I ever get between milchiks and fleishiks are rabbinic in nature. You really have to work hard to violate the Torah on milchiks and fleishiks grounds. Really not an easy thing, right? Plus, in most cases, the food remains kosher, b'dieved, after the fact, right? In most of the cases, the question is going to be, when was the last time this pan or this spoon or this whatever it is that got mixed up was used? Right, if it's more than 24 hours, usually it's not going to be a problem. The problem sometimes is the kli, the vessel. The spoon needs to be kosher. Pan needs to be kosher, something like that. That happens often. But the food itself very rarely becomes prohibited. And usually then, midrabanan, rabbinically. So I say this irony because when it comes to insects, that's very d'oraisa, very much Torah law. Okay, and each insect is a Torah law, right? Check it. There's a woman here, and there are all different kinds of insects: water insects, land insects, flying insects. Then there is another issue at hand, is that usually when it comes to all Yisroel, whether it's kashrus, Shemitah, whether it's Orla, Kilayim, or whether it's, for that matter, Basar v'Challav, or eating on Yom Kippur, or eating Chametz on Pesach, whatever it is, the din of what we shouldn't eat is defined by a certain shear, by an amount. That amount is usually a kezayis, the bulk of an olive, b'kedei achilas pras, in the time it takes to eat 3 eggs, or according to some opinion, 4 eggs. Not the actual egg, but the volume of 3 or 4 eggs of a wheat loaf. Okay, so that's the definition of what we shouldn't eat. But when it comes to insects, we can violate the Torah by eating a tiny, tiny ant, small gnat. Eat one of them, it violates the Torah. The reason for that is because an ant or a gnat or a mosquito is a what's called a beria. Beria means one whole item. Okay, the beria, which means that even though there is this, the difference might be often the bracha achrona, the bracha we make after eating, right? There's no bracha achrona unless we eat a shear, unless we eat an amount, which is a kezayis bechadei achilas pras, the bulk of an olive and the time it takes to eat 3 or 4 eggs. So when it comes, however, to eating a beria, now I'm not talking about eating insects. There's no bracha on eating insects, but there is a bracha achrona on eating, let's say, a raisin, right? Or one filbert, right? Because one filbert is a beria. Beria means like a whole item, one whole unit. Okay, a beria means that you don't have to eat an olive's bulk of pomegranate seeds in order to make a bracha achrona, because of one pomegranate seed is a beria. One raisin is a beria. Most of these fruits are not the size of an olive, right? Okay. By the way, not everybody agrees with this. There is enough poskim that say that even a raisin, sunflower seed, almond, you know, things where it's a whole one unit, but it's smaller, quite a bit smaller than an olive, that you have to eat an olive's bulk of those things also, right? An olive's bulk of raisins, an olive's bulk of sunflower seeds, etc., etc. Because of that difference, so that we don't put ourselves into a doubtful area, the custom is not to eat between one raisin and an olive bulk of raisin, or these other foods that are small. Because then we put ourselves into a doubtful area. Maybe we're supposed to make a bracha and we're not. Maybe we're not supposed to make a bracha and we are. Either way, we're in trouble, right? Okay, anyway, as in terms of our halacha, if we eat even one, you don't have to eat an olive's bulk of ants in order to violate the Torah. Even if we eat one ant. Now, what's the benchmark? What's the size? I mean, there are tiny insects we can't even see. Okay, that's the benchmark. Is that what you can see? We're not angels. If you can see the something swimming around in the water, right? Sometimes you can see really tiny insects and you can see them zipping around in a small pond. Those things should not be eaten, right? That was the famous copepods case in the water where it needed to be filtered because they weren't being filtered properly from the reservoirs. And you can actually take a glass from the water supply and see them swimming at the top of the glass. Those things can be seen by the human eye without any microscope or anything. Then we should not be consuming them. Okay. Now, that being said, I don't want to spoil your lunch if you haven't had it yet, but according to the United States Department of Food and Drug Administration or Health Administration, whatever it might be, every food in America and in other places, of course, every country has their own standard. And there are Gemaras like this, and Mishnah is like this in Bava Basra, that when you purchase, let's say, wheat, there's a certain amount of impurities that are allowed to come along with the wheat. Right? When you purchase certain fruits, there's a certain amount of leaves that can be also, you know, sold that make up of the bulk of the weight of the amount of fruit that you're buying. So when it comes to this Indian in America, chocolate or coffee or other things like frozen vegetables, there is sorry to gross anybody out, but the law is that they're allowed a certain amount of insect parts to make their way. I mean, you know, it's a lot less than shishim, right? But if there are insect parts in the middle of your frozen spinach or in the middle of your frozen broccoli, that's obviously a serious problem, right? So one of the excuses that some of the Hashgacha organizations allow is that those insect parts are chopped up, right? Once an insect part is chopped up, then you need a kizayis. Then the rule of Bata B'Shishim can kick in, right? If you see an ant or a tiny bug fall into your chalent, really that whole chalent should be aser. Why do we say that it's mutter? Because if the chalent is very hot, then it's very likely that that ant or that insect not only got chopped up, just disintegrated. It doesn't exist anymore. Then you have the din of bittul. Is the disintegration bakal b'shishin? Interest, of course, yes. An insect in a big chalent is bakal in 400,000. Okay. But here is the rub. A beria is not ever bakal. If it's a full beria, a full living item, whatever the size may be, it's not bottle if it maintains its integrity. It maintains its shape and its size. Okay, all right. That is an overview, just to begin with, of the issues regarding insects. I'm sorry, because they are Torah laws, and they have different special dinim of bittul. And let's start with page 239. Okay, so there are four different isurim, right? Number one, number two, and if you look here, number three and four. Let's see, here is three and four. There are four different psukim that prohibit all kinds of different insects. There are two regarding water insects. Okay. One of the insects, and another one is because if it lives in the water and it doesn't have fins and scales, it's usher if it's a dolphin, which doesn't have scales. And it's also usher if it's a swimming insect, because it's in the water and it doesn't have fins and scales. Right? So we would be violating, by eating a water insect, two different avodas. One, eating an insect, and two, eating a creature that lives in the water that doesn't have fins and scales. Okay, so if you have to choose between eating a land insect and eating a water insect, you should choose the land insect. Just saying. Okay, the land insect is just, okay. All right, the water insects, the land insects, and we have flying insects. Now, in addition, this sefer that you have in front of you lists, in addition, all kinds of secondary prohibitions at eating insects. Because the Torah says, don't eat anything lo teshaktsu, don't eat anything disgusting. Right? You see, don't eat anything repugnant. Right? So eating these things are repugnant. Okay. So that would be an additional violation. Okay. All right. But anyway, it's quite obvious. Land insects, water insects, flying insects, all of them violate the Torah and violate the Daraisa. Okay. So look at number six, Shulchan Aruch. This is, I basically told you this on the outside. Let's read it inside now. It says, Kedera shel marak. Shenafal sham beria v'novda asurako. Okay, pot of soup where a full creature Right? A whole living creature fell in and was lost inside. The entire thing is forbidden. And this shaded area, the contrast, is what I mentioned, that if the insect is mixed into food and dissolves so that it's no longer whole and it's impossible to locate, so then it is permitted because it's that can be bottled. Okay? All right? So that if it's no longer whole because the wing fell off or because it's chopped up, right? So there you would only get malchus for eating a kezias of it. Because this din that you don't need the kezias, you don't need an olive bulk, is only when it's a full burial, it's a full lamb. Okay. Okay. So that's the Rambam Paskins that way, right? That if an ant was missing a tiny little piece of it, filo achas miragleha. In one of its legs. You take a spider with daddy long legs or something and you just pull off one of the legs, then you have to eat a kezias in order to violate it. Okay? But we paskin that chatzi shir asur min haTorah, right? That when the Torah says don't eat pork, we get a punishment for eating a kezias of pork. But we're not supposed to eat a half a kezias of pork either, right? Chatzi shir is not asur min drabanan, it's asur min haTorah. Okay, and the din of not eating insects, as it says here, number 8, applies whether the insect is alive or dead. Okay. It says, Lefichach ha'ochel zvub shalem o yitush shalem. Bein chai uvein meis loke. Whether it's alive or it's dead, he is violates the Torah. And if it's full, then it has to be any shear. Any shear will violate the Torah. But if it's cut up, then it has to be a kezias. Okay. So look at the next page here. It says that due to the fact that many fruits, vegetables, sometimes contain insects in them, right? The halacha is that all types of fruits and vegetables that are often infested with insects must first be checked in a thorough manner before they're eaten, as recorded in Shulchan Aruch. Now, there are certain foods and also certain seasons where some foods are mamash muchzak betoloim, filled with worms, small worms. Certain types of lettuces, and again, it's often seasonal, depending on where the lettuce comes from, right? Some seasons, it's more than others. And, there are those who avail themselves in some of the stores. I mean, some of the most burdensome things to do in these stores is to check the lettuce, because especially certain types of lettuce that have very have leaves that are very crunched up, and some mesclun salads, and so it has to be soaked very readily in vinegar or salt water or warm water, and or another worthwhile thing to do with it is to have a stream, like some sinks come with like a gun where you can, the water comes out very fast and hard, and you hold that next to the lettuce, whatever was on there is going to come right off. All right. Also, what the restaurants do is they have what's called a light box. Okay. A light box is you put the lettuce down in the box, and if there's an insect on it, it's going to show up. Okay. All right. So let's look at the Aruch HaShulchan number 10. The Aruch HaShulchan lived at the end of the 19th century. He was the Torah Tamima's father. Okay. His name was Aaron Alevi Epstein. says, some have written the name of scientists that one who looks with a magnifying glass called a microscope will see that vinegar is full of insects. Ah, yikes. If you look under it with a microscope, now with regard to vinegar, there is no concern, as has been explained, because the Torah permitted insects that are created when detached from natural sources of water. Okay. But it's also because we don't see it. However, I've heard that all types of water, and especially rainwater, are filled with tiny creatures that are invisible. In my youth, I heard from one who lived far away and saw with a big magnifying glass, microscope, tens of thousands of creatures in the water. Those are bacteria. And according to this, how can we drink water? As these creatures are created in water form, right, in water from a natural source. But the truth is that the Torah did not forbid that which the eye cannot see, as the Torah was not given to angels. As if this is not the case, a number of the scientists have written that all of the air is also filled with the tiniest creatures. And when a person opens his mouth, he swallows some of them. Rather, their mouths certainly speak nonsense. But even if it is true, since they are invisible to the eye, they are insignificant. However, as much as the eye can see, even only opposite the sun, and even the thinnest of the thin is a bona fide insect. Yeah, it's true. Right, you ever see, like, remember they used to have the movie light that goes across? We don't have that anymore now, but, and you used to see all the, like, all that stuff that's through the light. That's all around the entire room. It's just that you see it only through that light. Right? There are these objects that are flying all over through the air. We just can't see it, right? How many of those objects are living things? Right? Well, the Torah only allows us to eat living things that have certain signs on them, right? And it's a mitzvah. Get this, we did this, I think, one of the first weeks. It's a mitzvah to know what those signs are. It's a fulfillment of the Torah to know what makes a kosher fish, a kosher locust, a kosher animal, and a kosher bird. Okay. So the Chabadas, this Avad Yosef, was asked, is there a prohibition on insects in the water or in fruits, even when they are only visible by a microscope? His answer is, the matter is clear that whatever the Torah forbids concerning items that are dependent upon checking by sight, are only by natural observation, as a person sees with his own eyes and judges according to the vision of his eyes, but not based on seeing through a microscope or a magnifying glass. Therefore, insects that are totally invisible to the eye are not subject to any prohibition, even though they are visible through a magnifying glass or microscope. Okay. Well, then you have to beg the question, what about insects, page 244, that are visible but difficult to see? Okay, so the Sefer HaKashrut says that it is not permitted to consume insects that are difficult to identify due to the background or because it is difficult to discern its shape. But if you can make them out, you can see them. You can see them darting in the water. You can see them flying in the air. Then, of course, these things would be prohibited. And some of the insects, some vegetables and fruits are so hard to even get in there to find out where the insects might be, that some hashgachas don't use them. And some of the things are in certain seasons: blueberries, strawberries, broccoli, cauliflower. What are these called? The tips, the asparagus tips. Okay. The Sefer Kashrut quotes certain rabbis about how they eat this, right? Let's see, this is number 13. Let's see it right here. Okay. Concerning a food that is difficult to clean in a definitive manner and is inspected for insects as much as possible, it is permitted to grind it in order to avoid any possible concern of consuming them. Again, this is what I said before. Now, the chiddush here is that you can do this lechatchila, right? You know what I'm saying? That you check it as much as you can to make sure that there's no shemets, no insects anywhere near the broccoli or the cauliflower or the asparagus. And then what you can do is just put it in a blender. Okay, whatever insect might have been in between the leaves, no longer considered an insect. So let's see the footnote. The suggestion is made by Hagona Rav Moshe Vaya in the name of Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashev, Rav Shlomo Shmuel Vazner, and Rav Ben Zion Abba Shaul, that the vegetable that is difficult to clean, such as parsley, that has been cleaned well with sponge and soap, and it is only a possibility that insects remain, it is permitted to grind it in a blender. In practice, according to Rav Ben Zion Abba Shaul, it is sufficient to cut it finely, even with a knife. So according to this, you don't even have to blend it. Just cut it with a knife. If there was an insect in there that was cut by the knife. On the other hand, according to Rav Eliashev, one must cut them such that the pieces are smaller than the insects, which would require a blender specifically. And of course, because if you cut the pieces larger than an insect, the original insect might remain on that piece. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach similarly permitted checking and cleaning broccoli and then grinding it finely in the blender. Now he brings down on page 247 something about inspection for insects by children. Right? What's the question? Well, because my son did some work as a mashkiach, and he said by far and away the most tedious, boring part of serving as a mashkiach, doing anything in kashrus, was the inspection of insects. Now there's Torah laws involved. Maybe a young child. Children means before bar or bas mitzvah. Maybe a young child is not going to be as careful and scrupulous about saving the people from eating things that are forbidden. Okay. So it says here, one witness. One witness is believed in matters of prohibitions. Of course, this happens all the time. Okay. If one witness said to him, your pure foods will render it impure, and the other is silent, he's believed. Okay, that's because eight echad neman b'yisurin. But the child is not believed to forbid it. Hey, look at the next page. Nevertheless, the Rambam writes that if a child attests to information concerning rabbinic prohibition, he is believed even if it yields a lenient conclusion, as long as the item does not already have a presumption being forbidden. Okay, if something has a presumption, a chazaka, that it's prohibited, then the information given to us by a katan, a minor, can be helpful. That's midrabban. Okay, so that's based, so they can only render a decision regarding a rabbinic prohibition. Okay, this is understandable because a Torah prohibition creates a God-made, what's called Chefzer Shel Isser. I'm going to feel very bad if I violate something God told me not to eat, even if I violate it by accident, by mistake. But if I violate something a person said not to eat, only because they wanted to possibly save me from violating the Torah, right? You get it? They put a fence around the mitzvah to save me from violating the Torah. So if I accidentally eat that, I don't have to feel bad. No. Okay. not create prohibitions. Rabbis from the day that Moshe died have one job, protect the Torah. Make sure that you enact zerot, tachanot, in order to protect the Torah. All right, so what is it that the child is attesting to, though? The child attests to something that is prohibited by the Torah, and he says, no, this is okay, this is permitted. That's a problem, because the child is creating a definition of something that has to do with Torah law. Is the child just clarifying something? Well, it depends on what we're asking the child about. There's some things where the child is asked not to paskin. You can't paskin if you're before Bar Bas Mitzvah or anything. But he's asked to clarify something. Right? Just a question of lending clarity. Probably the best example of this would be that in some circumstances where someone is laning the Torah, and he comes up to a question of whether a certain letter is a resh or a dalid, or is it a yud or a vav, right? Is it a chaf sofit, or is it a resh? You know, there's a question of whether the leg of the letter is long enough, that is, does it extend enough? So if we have a doubt, right? If it's a resh and it looks like a shin, of course that's a pasul Torah. But if it's between two letters that look alike, and we're not sure exactly which one it is, so the halacha allows us to call in a child. You call in a child, not so old that he knows what the letter is supposed to be, not so young that he doesn't know what the letter is at all. He's old enough, he's naive maybe, in Pitumo, he's... So you call him in and you just ask him. He's not giving you a psak. Is this letter resh or dal? You're just reading lefi tumo, what it looks like. And that can create a fact on the ground for us. Okay. It's a famous story. I think it was in Arad in Israel, where there was a shul in the morning that was doubtful whether the letter was a resh or a chaf, chaf sapit. And they called in a child to paskin, and the child read Hebrew, and he said it was a resh, which was the right letter, and they read the rest of the laning on that, and then afterwards they made a little correction. So afterwards they found out that the child was a Muslim. Okay. So the real problem is that he's not bar mitzvah. We're not asking him to render a psak. A 10-year-old kid, give a psak. Did you get it? We'll just ask him to clarify something. So anyone can do that. Jew or non-Jew, as long as he reads Hebrew. Okay, I'll admit that there's something to disagree with what I just said, but okay. All right. Okay. So you look here based on this ruling of the Rama, children may only inspect fruits and vegetables that are not presumed to be infested, as long as they don't have a chazaka for being filled with worms. What gives fruit a chazaka for being filled with worms? If you see three boxes, you know, one next to the other, or three sections, you know, right? So you create a presumption. Unless otherwise informed, you know, there's no reason to suspect. That's called a reyasa, where the chazaka gets a reyasa. The assumption is weakened. Right? We assume that all these things are kosher, except that if there's a reyasa, there's something that says something went wrong. And they stopped spraying for DDT, so there are a lot more insects that come in. There is an assumption that there are insects, not vice versa. Okay. But the Mishnah Berurah paskins that we should not usually rely on the inspection of a child. Okay. What about by non-Jews or non-observant Jews? So this could be a problem because the Rambam paskins that Jews who aren't observant, who violate Shabbos openly, when they have a din of a goy, they're like not, they're like Akum, they're not Jewish. Okay. All right. So that's the question. When you go into a restaurant and you see the person behind the counter, he's checking vegetables or he's doing other mashgiach, wouldn't you expect your mashgiach to be fully steeped in halacha and he's erlich? Well, I don't want someone who's watching over my food who's not himself keeping kosher. It's pretty absurd. Okay. Right, so the question of a Jew who's not religious involved in these, some of these decisions is a problematic one. Right? These decisions need to be made by a Yirei Shamayim, need to be made by a, not necessarily a Baal Horah, not a Posek, but there has to be someone who is clearly an accepted authority. Okay, let's see what happens when we talk about giving hashkachas that are being, you know, some of the organizations are just satisfied and happy that they found a Jew. Okay. One who is known to have violated one of the prohibitions of the Torah, except for idolatry, desecration of Shabbos publicly, or he does not believe in the word of our sages, is believed with regards to other prohibitions. Okay? He's a mummer for shatnas, he's a mummer for Lashon Hara, he violates other mitzvahs of the Torah. But kashrus he keeps, okay? You can rely on him. All right? So we ask in Yigush Moshe Yerideya, this is the first tshuva of Yerideya. Concerning a slaughter and one who inspects the animals afterwards to ensure it's kosher, about whom a rumor spread and had not stopped. Right? There was a lot of rumors. No one was saying that it's not true. Concerning his lack of reliability as a slaughterer, that he was disqualified from having credibility about slaughter and checking. Okay. Moshe wrote, but then he was accepted as a slaughter inspector in St. Louis. And therefore, since the rumor that did not stop was that he desecrated Shabbos many times, which means he is a mummer, a Shabbos, which is severe, even if it was only in private, one may not believe him concerning his slaughter, according to the Shach. Today, we would not use such a person for anything. We have plenty of people to do this work. We don't have to rely on people who are not observant. Okay. We should always assume that a mashgiach is, he has to be a Yirei Shamayim, and he also has to be talented enough to know what to do. Right? He has to be able to stand up to the people if he sees something that's not toward, and he has to set them straight. For these things, it's always best that the mashgiach works for the OU or an organization. Right? Not that he's working for the store, that he's getting paid by the store. If he's there, he knows that he's getting paid by them. He might be too lenient about whether the lettuce can be used or other things like that. Okay. Right, he should work for the local VAD, or the OU, or the OK, or something like that. Right? Okay, and finally, he says that a non-Jew is not acceptable because he's not keeping kosher. He doesn't have any interest in in doing this, but it would appear then that someone who's on the process of converting to Judaism does know how to be careful and does know how to do it right. Okay. So that's on non-observant Jews. Now he's having inspection clinics by women. Okay. So here the Aruch HaShulchan cites some poskim that say that women should not be mashgichim because they might not be careful. And he gets crazy, blows up about this. Here in some pebes. See? Concerning the matter itself, I am astonished. How is it possible? God forbid that our women will be lenient about prohibitions because of the effort. Don't we see their extensive effort concerning any matter related to a prohibition? It is not similar to differentiating non-kosher and kosher fish occasionally, and therefore they may not know or understand, and they will decide to be lenient due to their laxity. So the answer is that there are many places where a woman serves as mashgiach. Okay. And that's why it says that Sefer Kashrut, any man, male or female, has reached the age of mitzvot, bar bas mitzvot, has credibility in inspecting food substances for insects. This is on the condition that they know how to check and that they're familiar with the insects, and we want to switch for them. Okay? I think I'm just going to finish this inspection for insects on Shabbos, and that'll close out this section here. Okay. All right. So on the next page, the problem is going to be that perhaps inspecting for insects is like a tikkun. It's fixing things for Shabbos. Not a fixing, not a tovel keli, because before they weren't usable, now they are. Right? So question for Sefer Kashrus. Is it forbidden to rinse or soak romaine lettuce and the like in vinegar solution of salt water to remove insects? Right, so here, see this paragraph. Right, you're allowed to check them for insects according to the halacha. And if you find a large insect, you can remove it. It doesn't violate borer, which is selecting something out of something you want. But if one finds small insects, one should remove them together with a small amount of vegetable or food. Just don't take them by themselves. Take it with a little of the stuff that's there. Okay, that's very famous halacha with respect to borer. Don't take the only thing you don't want and take it out and throw it out. You take that thing with a little something that's actually essentially permitted. Okay, let's see what this says here. Okay, this is number 27. There was once an incident involving a Torah scholar rented a certain pork drum the day before Pesach. And so the housewife had two large baskets full of horseradish, and she was washing all the leaves and checking them quickly while placing them in the basket. The Torah scholar said to her, "How many hairs are there on your head?" She said to him, "I have not counted them, and I don't believe this, that you can count them." He responded to her, "You can count the hairs on your head, but the number of sets of lashes that are upon your head right now cannot be counted." She said to him, "What should I do? There are a lot of people in the family, and they wish to eat a large amount of horseradish because they like it." He said to her, "This answer will not save you on the day of judgment. Therefore, listen to my advice and throw out all the leaves that need a significant amount of checking, and take only the stalks, and likewise for the karpas. Check only a small amount, specifically only enough to fulfill the obligation of the mitzvah, but no more." Okay, the next week, there are still some more issues regarding checking. Okay. All right. Okay, everybody. I want to wish everybody a good week.